Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. During World War II, Japan and the United States were bitter enemies. But as the World War ended and the Cold War began, Japan quickly became America's most important ally in Asia. This morning, we will look at how it is this change came about so quickly, and particularly how Americans changed their attitudes toward Japan. And our guest is historian Naoko Shibasawa. She's a cultural historian who specializes in U.S. foreign relations and in Asian American history. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in her book, her first book, titled America's Geisha Ally, Reimagining the Japanese Enemy. This book is published by the Harvard University Press and has recently come out. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore if you're interested in taking a look at it. Our guest was born in Japan, came to the United States when she was a preschooler, grew up several places around the country, New York, Texas, California. She's a graduate of Northwestern University, and that's where she got her PhD in history. She's taught history at the University of Hawaii for a number of years before taking up her post now, where she is a professor of history at Brown University. She's been there now for a couple of years. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-9455. Again, that's for Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, no matter where you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. And that is, again, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief so that we can keep the program moving. But anybody is welcome to join us. Professor Shibasawa, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We certainly appreciate it. I think before starting into talking about the subject of the book, I think that it's worth reminding people, and there will be some people, well, including me, for whom the World War II was not part of their life experience, to remind them about this war, and particularly how this war, the Pacific War, and how the images that Americans were given of the Japanese was different from the war in Europe. That's not to say that the Germans, that the Nazis weren't demonized, but there seemed to be a quality about the images that Americans were given of the Japanese that was fundamentally different. And I know that there are a number of scholars that have written about this. I guess the guy I think of is John Dower, who's written a lot and quite eloquently on the role of race in the Pacific War. Maybe that would be a good place to start out.
Yeah, so I guess that is a good place to start out. So in John Dower's book, which is a sort of seminal book on the war, War Without Mercy, he points out something that I think that that you can see if you just kind of even look back at old movies of the war, or if you're able to like flip back and look at anything from the period, which shows that whereas in Germany, in the German war, there was always a good German. Americans knew that they were fighting the Nazis. The Nazis were to be vilified, and there was Hitler and all that. But on the other hand, there was always this idea of the good German, that the good German are those who are redeemable and who could be possible allies of the United States. On the other hand, in the Pacific War, all Japanese were vilified as enemy. And as Dower shows, they were worthy of not much. I mean, they were kind of targeted for elimination. One thing that he shows in his book, he cites, I think, is a Gallup poll, that after the atomic bombs were dropped in Japan in August 1945, a poll of Americans was done, and it showed that many Americans were saying that if it were more atomic bombs, they would like to drop even more atomic bombs on Japan if they were existing at the time. So there was, in a sense, because of the sort of race war, more of a, I don't know if I want to put it quite this way, but almost like a genocidal rage, in a sense, against the Japanese. That makes sense?
Yeah. And so that, just having established that, then that shows you that when we do get to the point where the war has concluded and the United States is thinking about the Cold War and tensions with the Soviet Union and the importance of having allies, it perhaps would be natural that we might think of Japan as an important ally. But here now, the government would have a real challenge to persuade Americans that this is a good thing after having had now this other set of attitudes about Japan.
Right. And then the thing what happened is that these ideas of Japan that came in the post-war period didn't just come out of the blue, because there had been a relationship with Americans and the Japanese since Perry, since the opening of Japan. But in particular, from like the late 19th century through the early 20th century, there was something called the Japan craze, in which many Americans found out about the Japanese, found out about the geisha, found out about the pagodas, found out about all these sort of consumer goods that came from Japan. And so it was this sort of, they saw Japan as, in a sense, like this Oriental Eden, in a sense. So there were these sort of like old, quaint images of Japan. And these images were sort of resurrected in the post-war period to help rehumanize the Japanese. And what I argue in my book is what happens is that Americans rely on notions of women and children to rehumanize the Japanese.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. I think right at the very beginning, you talk about the fact that soldiers who came as part of the occupation, who would have come with this attitude that most people would have had about the Japanese, that they were savage monsters. They were coming to Japan, and that the good, perhaps you would say in a sense, the goodwill ambassadors in Japan for the Japanese were children and women, and that when these soldiers first encountered these little kids and they encountered the Japanese women, that it was not what they expected. Maybe they even expected, they went in with this attitude, they were telling themselves, well, this was the enemy, in some sense it still is the enemy. It seems that they were disarmed, that the Americans were disarmed here fairly quickly by their initial contacts with women and children.
Well, during the war, the image of the Japanese is that they were fanatical, and that they were suicidal, and that they were crazy, and that they were crazy devoted to this emperor. And so they went into Japan, and also the fact that, beginning with the war at Pearl Harbor, that the Japanese are treacherous and backstabbing, and you can't trust them at all. And so Americans, understandably, went into Japan very, very wary, but found that the Japanese had been thoroughly defeated, did not want to fight anymore, and were really quite happy, frankly, that the war was over. And so they found themselves reacting positively, especially to women and children. And what I argue in my book is not just that they were women and children and that the children were cute and the women were docile or helpful or subservient or what have you, but what it did is that it sort of helped Americans understand the subjugation of Japan in a way that naturalized the hierarchy. And by that, I'm talking about how, like, there are, like, ways in which anybody, people in the world, think about how relationships should be, relationships that have to do with power, which is that, that men should be in control of women. Well, maybe not so much anymore, but used to be, right? The men should be in control of women. Yeah. But certainly that adults should be in charge of children. So these are sort of, like, ways in which we think of how relationships should be. And these relationships are kind of put into a metaphor, and they naturalize or make seem commonsensical power relationships. And so if, the relationship started out with these GI encounters with actual women and children, but in a sense they took this immediately and made it into a larger metaphor about the Japanese as a whole.
Well, and it seemed that it's very obvious that there was a patriarchal quality to this relationship, and that is that America saw Japan as being, and it's sort of amazing to say this given the fact that Japan had a very distinct and very long culture and history, but that saw Japan as in a country that was immature, that was in need of development, and that the United States would be able to help, that it was it saw it very much as a kind of a parent-child relationship.
Yeah. See, so I think that other people have pointed this out, the sort of paternalism that you often find, especially in colonial relationships.
Hmm.
And so, for instance, when the Americans went into the Philippines at the end of the 19th century, You had like Taft, Howard Taft, who was the general governor there, describing the Filipinos as our little brown brothers. But they also believed, because they wanted to keep up that colonial relationship and build up a colonial infrastructure, that he was also saying that our Filipino brown brothers wouldn't be ready for democracy or ready to handle independence for at least 100 years or more. By the end of World War II, when colonies were being, you know, freed or what have you, even when the United States had given up the Philippines, it got its independence in 1946, this idea of having colonies no longer fit the United States policy or geopolitical needs. There was other ways to maintain or to spread American power without the need for formal colonial structures. And so what you find in the post-war period is this idea that other peoples, they tended to be non-white peoples, were less mature, less developed in this sort of, you know, unilinear sort of path to modernity as the Americans were. But yet, while the hopes of the, while the sort of promises of the imperialists to uplift the other and to, you know, educate themselves to be ready for independence was false in the earlier period, they're much truer by the end of World War II and in the occupation period. So there was every expectation that this Japanese, as MacArthur described infamously, boy of 12, would grow up more quickly and be ready to handle independence and democracy. Mm-hmm. And another reason why, even though Japan was an older society, I should point out, than the United States, another reason why the United States or Americans were able to describe the Japanese as immature is this notion that's kind of left over from social Darwinism of the earlier period, in which that that the Western man, I'll say, not in, because this is also gender, is just more advanced along this universal path to modernity and enlightenment. And therefore, even though Japan is an older civilization, so to speak, their civilization was not advanced as much as the West, or in particular the United States. Mm.
Our guest, let me just introduce our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last few minutes, Naoko Shibasawa. She is Assistant Professor of History at Brown University. She's a cultural historian who specializes in U.S. foreign relations and Asian American history and is the author of a recently published book, America's Geisha Ally, Reimagining the Japanese Enemy. It's published by the Harvard University Press and takes a look at this period right after World War II and looks at this very significant, dramatic, fundamental change in the attitudes that Americans had about Japan and the Japanese. A big shift from the kind of attitudes that were prevalent during World War II to those that came after in the occupation and the Cold War, when Japan went from being an enemy of the United States to being an ally of the United States. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm sure that the U.S. government and the U.S. military knew that its soldiers would be coming to Japan for the occupation with a certain set of images of the Japanese and would have thought that it was important for things to go smoothly, for these soldiers to behave themselves, to make a good impression on the Japanese. What were these soldiers told as a way of preparing them to actually encounter in this way Japan, Japanese people, Japanese culture there on the soil of Japan?
Well, they were given a pamphlet. I guess this is probably what's happening in to the soldiers who are going to Iraq today, is that they were given a pamphlet, a pocketbook to Japan. And they were also shown this movie, Our Job in Japan. And the emphasis of both these, you know, these sort of guides, orientation materials to the U.S. soldiers was to point out that these folks may have strange customs, may seem different from you, but our purpose, or your purpose as an American, is to serve as a goodwill ambassador, to show through example, through kind manners and good treatment, that you want to convince these people who have been oppressed by the imperialist militarists that they would want to follow the sort of more democratic American way. And this was emphasized in these books. At the same time it was emphasized in the books is a focus on Japanese culture. Again, this which wasn't completely new to them. They had all heard about the geisha. They knew that she was about something, you know, something sexy, something desirable. And they also knew about Japanese, you know, I don't know, like Japanese dolls or Japanese, you know, flower arrangements and things like that. And so the sort of cultural, more feminized aspect of Japanese culture was emphasized. And at the same time, what you find is you find that that the so-called bad Japanese emerges in this period as well, too. The so-called bad Japanese wasn't existing in the wartime period when all Japanese were bad. But in the post-war period, they did the separation in which the bad Japanese, of course, become Tojo and the so-called militarists. But these were the bad Japanese who led the poor, you know, good Japanese the wrong way, and that was the time for Americans to show the majority of Japanese who were good to come towards the American way.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that you made reference to that famous quote of Douglas MacArthur, where he was talking about European culture and Japanese culture, and he was making this argument that he was coming from this place that said, well, European culture is is mature culture. It's as if you're talking about a person who is in their prime.
Let me explain that.
Maybe you could talk about that a little bit more. The thing that I'm interested in is his saying that you know, sort of Anglo-Saxon culture, they're like, it's like a person in their prime, and that Japan is like a boy of 12. And the thing that I think is interesting there is that he says it's like a boy of 12, and maybe that's what you would do. I'm just thinking about the fact, though, that is in so much of particularly American popular culture, what is emphasized is women. The images we see, they're images of women. Children, yes, boys and girls, but also with adults, mostly what you're seeing is women.
Okay. So when you're thinking about, like, I don't know, like members of the geisha and things that are around now, you see more images of women because that's what's popular and that's what's
well. I suppose in a way you still do, but I'm thinking of, you know, particularly what you would see in popular culture in those immediate years, say the late 40s, the early 50s of Japan, and you see, if you saw people, probably most of them would be women. I guess I'm thinking about, you know, the images of the United States and of Americans. Chances are they would be male, perhaps because they would be soldiers, and the images that you would see so much of the Japanese, they would be women.
Right, and this was something that was very marked, and especially like in Life magazine, that post-war period. You know, there was hardly any images of women and children during the war, but all of a sudden, you know, after the war, all these images were mostly of women and small children. And what's really interesting also about that is that it wasn't a real conscious decision to say, hey, let's just put women in there. I actually contacted an old Life journalist whose husband, Carl Meidens, was head of Japan and a photographer, and I pointed this out to her, and she just refused to see it, saying, no, that didn't happen. We just chose any picture that seemed like a good picture. But on the other hand, she admitted that, well, there was this sort of, you know, subconscious or effort we knew to sort of, you know, show Americans that the Japanese weren't just buck-toothed Jap soldiers with their Coke bottle eyeglasses. And so that attempt was made. Yet on the other hand, too, if you go back and look at the primary sources of the period, you will find instances, like I have this whole chapter on the first Japanese student to come to a U.S. college, about the young man who's going to be the student of democracy. In a sense, when you see Japan like moving and striving towards becoming an adult-like democracy, you see them figured as males. And I think that the reason why MacArthur, can I give the example? Can I explain that about MacArthur?
Yeah, please do. I didn't mean to close off your doing that. Yeah, please.
So what happened is that MacArthur, we know, is fired. He's fired because he's overstepped his bounds in fighting the Korean War, so Truman fires him. He comes back to the United States, and he has to give this sort of hearing in front of the Senate Committee on Armed Forces. And, you know, he's bragging about the job that he did in Japan because he felt like it was a success, and he said something to the effect of, you know, the Japanese have embraced democracy, and once you have democracy, they'll never go back. No one ever goes back once after embracing democracy. And then one senator says, but General, what about the Germans? The Germans had democracy in the 1920s, and they turned their backs on it. And then that general says, aha, well, that's a different case altogether. The Germans were a mature race, whereas the Japanese were a boy of 12. And he was describing how the Germans, they knew what they were doing. They went off on their own path, whereas the Japanese really had no clue as to what they were doing, and they kind of stumbled into this war. And in that sense, I mean, that really insulted the Japanese because, you know, at that point they really had revered, you know, General MacArthur. We're going to build a statue of him. They can honor Citizen Japan and all that. But it really struck a nerve to the Japanese because they, too, had been describing other people as immature vis-a-vis the Japanese just a short time earlier. How, you know, the Chinese children or the Korean children need the uplift and the help of the Japanese to, you know, raise its standards to the level of modernity. So that's where it's coming. And the anger about that sort of, you know, this using this metaphor maturity. So my point there is this isn't something that Americans just do by themselves. This is like a fundamental way in which many people order the world, right, and figure out who deserves power, who doesn't deserve power. And that is always something that the powerful use to describe the relationship with the powerless.
Yeah.
That makes sense, right? But what the case I'm trying to make about pointing out the fact that MacArthur said not a child of 12, but a boy of 12, is that girls, especially in 1948, 1950, you know, they don't grow up to lead society. They don't grow up to, you know, to become leaders of a democratic society. And so the fact that MacArthur is saying a boy at 12 is the idea that the boy of 12 is going to grow up to become a young man who's going to become the leader of this new democratic government. Now, I'm saying this right now. I mean, it sounds odd to say this in 2007 because, of course, we think that girls grow up and they become women and they're able to become, you know, leaders as well, too. But there's that sense that that was there then, and to some degree it's still existing today in a more subtler form than it was in an earlier period. You can just look at that by looking at our Congress right now and looking at the gender disparity there. But the point is that men are the ones who are going to grow up and go on. And so the America's actually set up, as they did also for the Germans too, these scholarship programs to bring Germans and Japanese to the United States to educate them in the ways of American democracy so that they can spread the good news, like gospel, so spread the gospel at home among their countrymen. And they try to identify so-called potential leaders to do this. And if you look at the people who came, especially those from the Japanese side I study more, of course, is that they're almost all males. And they're almost all males, of course, elite families who are already well-connected. And then the one that I study in particular, I have a chapter about, is this man named Robert Nishiyama. Interestingly enough, he has a Christian first name or a Western first name, Robert. And he actually was going to be a kamikaze pilot. But the war fortunately saved his life. He was very glad not to have to smash a plane against an American ship. And he was working. He also was bilingual for some reason. And signed up for the scholarship that was formed, incredibly enough, there were also private scholarships that Americans made as well. And this one scholarship was rather remarkable because it was made by a family whose beloved son was killed by the Japanese in the Philippines. And they didn't know what to do. This man, young man's name was Robert Johnstone. I think he was like 19 when he died. He was going to Lafayette College in eastern Pennsylvania. He didn't shirk his duty when he got drafted. He went to war, and he was dead within about 6 months. And the government insurance money that came to the family didn't know what to do with. And so the family decided, basically the father, was to form a scholarship at Lafayette College in his son's name to show the enemy, you know, the sort of Christian, they were not nominal Christians, but true Christians, in a sense, really, you know, believed in turning the other cheek and reaching out and being missionaries, in a sense. And so the senior, Robert Johnstone, wanted the Japanese, the enemy, to see the light, to see the mistake in what they did in waging this war, and so proposed to have a scholarship established in his son's name to do that. And Robert Nishiyama, through a competition, turned out to be that first fellowship recipient. And I'm not sure if it's still existing, but it existed for quite a long time, and a bunch of them came that way. But Mr. Yoshiyama was one of, I don't know, a couple thousand maybe or so, I'm not quite sure how many, of Japanese students who came to the United States during this post-war period. And some of them ended up becoming academics and actually staying in the United States One of them is a very famous Japanologist who recently retired from Harvard, Akira Irie. He was one of those two who came in at post-war period.
Yeah, I know him, actually.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So he came in at post-war period, yeah. And the point I wanted to make about that is even though it was meant for Japanese to go back and spread the good news about the United States, what they did in turn actually was to serve as goodwill ambassadors for Japan in the United States and end up trying to explain themselves, their culture, try to humanize the Japanese to Americans, their former enemies, while they were in the United States.
We are at our midpoint here. I have a caller I want to see to get in and, again, to introduce our guest, Naoka Shibasawa. She is assistant professor of history at Brown University. She specializes in her work in U.S. foreign relations and also Asian American history. And her book that we're talking about here is America's Geisha Ally, Reimagining the Japanese Enemy. It's published by Harvard University Press, and as we have explained, looks at this period right after World War II and the change in Americans' attitudes and perceptions about Japan from the point of the war where the two countries were enemies to the point where we move from World War II into the Cold War when Japan becomes a very important ally of the United States in East Asia. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Urbana is our caller here, and we'll talk with him in line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Mm-hmm.
I rather enjoy the feminization metaphor that you use for Japan. And your period is like what, in the early 50s, like 1950, late 45, 50 to 55, something like that?
Yes.
That the period you're dealing with?
Yeah.
And also like the idea of you drawing in, which a lot of people do, the paternalism of the West towards what you'd call it now, they're now first world, but then after they've been bombed into oblivion, third world countries. But also, I want to ask you something about, I've been watching the population, you know, the public discussion of the population decline in Japan, you know, the slowness of birth rate, I mean, below replacement. And I'm wondering if you've seen or read anything, or I mean, maybe that relevant to your story, to your book, but is there something to the effect that after this war, which was really horrific for the island of Japan, you know, they burnt Tokyo to the ground, they dropped two atomic bombs. Do you think that, I know how the, maybe your statement is your book seems to imply that the West sort of flipped the Japanese from the brutal, murderous soldiers that they actually were. I mean, I had an uncle that fought in Iwo Jima and fought in Manchuria after the war, actually mopping up Japanese army divisions. But turn them into these, like, the feminine side of their culture, but do you think that there's something to the fact that these people have, like, almost like a latent cultural, I don't know, apathy about living because of this war and because of the way they were humiliated at the end?
Oh.
I mean, I'm wondering if there's something to that, why they just... I know there. I'm sorry, I don't want to carry on, but I just wondered if there's something to that.
Oh, interesting. No, I actually don't think it's that. I think the decreased birth rate has to do with Japanese affluence,
mm-hmm.
right? And as you know, like as people become more affluent, they don't have as many children.
Yeah.
It's affluence, and also how expensive it is in Japan to raise children.
Yeah.
I think it has to do more with material cost rather than some sort of cultural notion about being defeated. Because if you think now, I mean, like, you know, mm-hmm. I was born in 64, so I grew up with images or, you know, memories of the war that my parents told me and whatnot, stuff like that. But most of the people, younger people who are, you know, are starting families and stuff like that now, they don't really have these notions of the war. As far as they know, Japan's always been a wealthy, pretty well-off country.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't remember, as like my parents do, when Japan was completely devastated, when people were starving, middle-class, upper-class people were starving. They don't remember any of that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that there's any sort of, you know, residual sort of cultural depression from being so thoroughly defeated. Because the other thing that they knew before the bubble burst recently was that Japan was a first-rate, powerful country that was admired for its culture and anime and all that sort of stuff throughout the world. So I don't think I would make that connection. But there's one thing I do want to say, which is even though I'm talking about like how the Japanese were vilified and they were seen as apes and insects worthy of extermination, stuff like that, I don't want in any sense at all to be seen as an apologist for Japanese empire.
Oh, you know, yeah, I never thought you were.
Yeah, but I just wanted to put that out there because every once in a while, I know this isn't you, I get kind of like scolded by some elderly Chinese man who wants to tell me
I'm sure you would. Yeah, but I wanted to ask you, I wanted to say something else. I have a doctorate in art history, and one of the things I learned in studying Western art in the late 19th and early 20th century is the really profound influence of Japanese art on Western art, especially in the flattening of space on canvas. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, because they'd gone from perspective, you know, no perspective to everything was perspective, back to using Japanese print and screen printings and stuff like that. It was just amazing how much that, I don't know whether it filtered down to the average American or European's ideas of the Japanese, whether, you know, you see like the Japanese print in some magazine or something and make the association of its influence. But, yeah, I was going to say, but I really appreciate your the subject and... it's real interesting. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
Other questions are welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm interested in returning here to a little bit to talk about images of Japan and the Japanese in American popular culture and how that perhaps also helped Americans to see the Japanese in a different way or perhaps see them in a way that they had once before seeing them, but they had been interrupted by the war. And I'm thinking, for example, there's a wonderful photograph here in the book. It's a reproduction of Life magazine. It was a cover of Life magazine in September of 1964. And here is a woman all done up in full geisha regalia. She's wearing a kimono and she's bowling. And it's great. Unfortunately, she didn't have to do that wearing geta. She's got tabi socks out. So she's in her stocking feet, and she's bowling, and she's smiling, and it's just I'm sure it was a brilliant photo in color, and this goes back to that idea that this was, you know, whether it was conscious or not. I'm sure that in Western media they saw images like that, and they saw, well, this makes a wonderful visual impact. It's nice composition. It would have been very colorful. And that while they might not have deliberately selected images like that, they would have thought, well, this is a great picture and it would be a natural. So that is why I'm sure at the time we had lots and lots of, in magazines like Life and Look and other picture magazines, plenty of pictures of pagodas and cherry blossoms and women dressed like this, maybe not necessarily bowling, but, you know, wearing very traditional Japanese costume. And that I can't help thinking that that was in some way deliberate and that also somehow that really had an impact on what Americans thought about Japan.
Well, that was a special Life magazine issue devoted to Japan in 1964 because of the Tokyo Olympics, and they sent a whole team of Life photographers and everything like that. And this whole special issue of here's our enemy after our former enemy after this many years after the war, and see how far it's come. But if you think about it, if you talk to the average American and you say, give me three images of Japan, the geisha is going to be one of the top three, right? Some woman in kimono, right? And so in that sense, knowing that, and this, of course, is a magazine that wants to sell, that is a reason, not, naturally it just comes up in the minds of Americans to put that on there, and that's how they associate Japan. I could be corrected, but I really think that's true, because I actually had a student once at the University of Hawaii who was from Japan, and she was just, you know, kind of very irritated by the fact that there was all this focus on the geisha in the United States. She's like, this is such a marginal kind of cultural institution in Japan that really is divorced from Japanese everyday reality and is only for a few elite men who can enjoy the geisha, what have you. But why are the Americans so obsessed with it? Why are the Americans so entranced with the geisha, this sort of feminized figure? And so that's why that is, I think, a big reason why the geisha always pops up, you know. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I found interesting about the post-war period, and I don't know, I see as much in the sort of recent movies, Hollywood productions about Japan, but in the post-war period, there's a whole spate of kind of B or A-level movies that came out about Japan around, starting from like 1955 to about 1960-something or rather. And all of them were sort of like, it was sort of the encapsulation of this whole process of remaking the enemy into an ally. And I guess the biggest and most famous movie, if people know about it, is Sayonara, which was a James Michener novel that was made into a movie starring Marlon Brando. And but what these movies were about was, in a sense, and it's interesting because it's 1955. You think about what else is happening in the United States in 1955, i.e., Brown, you know, or just right after Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, is that race is definitely an issue, right? And what you find in these sort of movies about Japan are all these lessons, and they're kind of like, you know, pointed lessons about how Americans need to become more racially tolerant. That the Americans, they also had to grow up. They also had to reject these sort of immature, and they actually say this, immature racist notions of other people. That to become world citizens, to become world leaders, Americans have to be true to their ideals of democracy, and especially if Americans want to woo over third world nations into the American orbit rather than the Soviet orbit, that they had to do this sort of work. And so these Hollywood movies, in a sense, are kind of like have this sort of educational purpose as well, too. And the reason why it's also important is that, as many scholars have shown is that the Soviet Union actually used American racism, vis-a-vis especially African Americans, as a reason why Americans were insincere about being leaders of democracy. And so knowing that all this is going on, you have to put it in the larger historical context, this message about having to be nicer to these other people who were a former enemy becomes very important. Yet on the other hand, it becomes more palatable and easier to handle than the more trickier relationships with African Americans at home, right? Mm-hmm. Because the Japanese are, of course, until recently, Asian Americans made up only like 3% of the population. You know, they weren't a huge presence except for places in the West. But then after the war, they were dispersed more, what have you. It's also because there was an immigration law that prevented Asians from immigrating to the United States. Anyway, having that, you know, being nice and feeling nicer to these Japanese abroad, in a sense, brought up the same issues, but not in the sort of forthright manner that really had to be dealt with in the 1950s.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, these cases we have of these movies, that they should come at this time. Movies like the one that you mentioned, Sayonara, this movie where Marlon Brando plays this American Air Force officer who goes to Japan really prepared to reject Japan, the Japanese culture. Interestingly enough, he's a Southerner as well.
Which he wasn't in the book.
So he's this Southern boy. If you can imagine Marlon Brando with this kind of drawl, and he goes there and ends up actually falling in love with a Japanese woman. That it's interesting that shortly after the war, you would see a movie like that that not only has this constructive message about how you think about the Japanese, but also deals with what would at the time been an extremely controversial topic, that is interracial romance.
Right.
And there are a number of movies that were produced around that time that that deal with that theme. You wonder whether, was this, when these movies were made, were the people that made them thinking about that? Did they just think that they would be good stories, that they would sell a lot of tickets? Or was there in some sense some idea somewhere that said, well, this is really it's important that we tell this kind of story because it has these larger geopolitical, ultimately has these larger geopolitical implications?
That's actually kind of a complicated question to answer directly, because these Hollywood films so fit, you know, the sort of needs of the American state, you kind of wonder what hand did the American state have in this, right? But what you find is there's never quite a direct connection, right? This is not how it works in the United States. You find that people do this independently, but for predictable reasons. I don't know if I'm making quite sense there. But so what you find in these movies, or you find, is that these are American white men. You never see, you know, non-white men, really, except for one movie with Nisei. You never see, like, a black man, in a sense, right, in these movies. Going to Japan, who's bigoted, and then they fall in love with a Japanese woman, and, you know, and everything's hunky-dory after that. And if they have any sort of problems, it's because of these bad, immature, racist people who try to thwart true love between the white guy and the Japanese woman. And so what you find is that in a sense, the reason why Mishner wrote this book is, first of all, he observed it. There were a bunch of American GIs who went to Japan, actually did fall in love with Japanese women, and did actually, you know, marry. A lot of them didn't marry their girlfriends, what have you, but a lot of them married them. So you want to sort of talk about that. And the makers of Sayonara, Joshua Logan, director in particular, wanted to bring this to the big screen, right? Wanted to bring this out to the big screen, in a sense. And then what I did in researching the movies, I actually went to the Hollywood archives. And so I, you know, the Warner Brothers archive is housed at USC. And so I looked at some of the production notes. And I also looked at, like, what, you know, Logan had said in his autobiographies. And what you find in the sort of publicity mill for these movies, you have, you know, them sort of bragging, you know, we've come a far, far way since Madame Butterfly, right? Because in that Madame Butterfly story, you find that Pinkerton, remember the Madame Butterfly in which, you know, a naval lieutenant, Pinkerton, goes to Japan, has an affair, a wife with his Madame Butterfly, Cho-Cho's son. They have a child, but in the end, he leaves her and goes back to the United States and marries a white woman, right? And then she commits suicide. That's the sort of tragic ending of Madame Butterfly. And what Mishner does, actually, in his original book is he actually has Sayonara means a bittersweet parting between the two lovers, that the lieutenant has to leave Hanaogi, his dancer lover, behind, and he goes back to the United States to marry another general's daughter. That's supposed to be the end, and so Sayonara is a bittersweet ending. But what I found out in my research is that they changed the ending to it because of Marlon Brando, the star. Marlon Brando said he wasn't going to participate in any sort of film that had these sort of arrogant racist ending as Madame Butterfly. And so you find in the end of the movie that Sayonara means Sayonara to the dance troupe, because this one was a professional dancer, and Sayonara to the Air Force, and that they were going to go off and get married despite the difficulty and the resistance, in a sense. Mishner decided, yeah, perhaps that ending was turned out to be better than the one that he had initially put out in the first place. And so that's the sort of change in there. Is that so? In a sense, I mean, I find, you know, there's nothing direct that says, okay, to have this interracial relationship will help the U.S.-Japan relationship. There's nothing that comes out like that in a direct way. Mm-hmm. It comes out in indirect ways that you have to sort of do. The difficulty about being a cultural historian versus being like a straight diplomatic historian is that we never have the memo, the smoking gun that says, aha, let's depict the Japanese as women and children, because that will make the American public, you know, feel better towards the Japanese, and that will help our efforts to make Japan a bulwark against communism in the Far East. You will never ever find, at least I've been able to find, a document like that in National Archives. The way culture works is I'm looking at, like, long-standing narratives and ideas and ideology in our culture to show how they support policy. See? And so, while there has been many, many studies that have been done very well that show why Japan had to become an ally in the post-war period, i.e. the Cold War, what I was trying to do is to show how this was done after such a brutal and racist war. Am I making sense?
No, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so, I guess that's my sort of long-winded answer to what you were asking.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, and I have another caller here that I want to get to. And just very quickly, I want to tell people who are listening that our guest is Naoka Shibasawa. She is assistant professor of history at Brown University. She is indeed a cultural historian. She's particularly interested in U.S. foreign relations and in Asian American history. And let's go to this next caller, someone in Champaign, and line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. In terms of intermarriage, when you look at Asian countries, if you look at Japan, you know, more closed in that regard, and not really against intermarriage. And then you take Korea, which is sort of somewhat similar. But when you get down to China, it doesn't seem to have as much of a problem with it. And then Thailand seems to not have any problem with it at all. So, what would explain this for a way? Could you just?
Well, I mean, actually, I'm not sure I actually know that or agree with you. I wouldn't say necessarily that the Japanese are more resistant to intermarriage than the Chinese. But actually, from, like, if you look at Asian Americans in particular, mm-hmm. right? If you look at Asian Americans, you'll find that the Japanese Americans have the greatest rate of outmarriage. In fact, it's very rare nowadays to find a Japanese American married another Japanese American. The rate of outmarriage is so great. I guess you're talking about Japanese nationals and Chinese nationals, yes, but I'm not quite sure.
But in terms of the country itself, if you were to live in Japan, it would be, and this is not being critical, you know.
No, I mean, I just haven't observed it, so I don't know if I'm equipped to answer it, because I can't quite say that I've seen that. I mean, is it because you've been in Asia and you've just observed, or I'm not?
Just based on students, when I taught in Chicago, students that I had in Chicago, that it would seem that the parents were very much opposed to it, and particularly among the Japanese and also the Koreans. But anyway,
that's interesting. I just haven't seen that at all. I mean, I found that among when I talk to my Korean American students, they say that they are. The thing is that Asians are still racist as well, right? And so you find that the Korean students are seeing that their parents are saying, don't marry Japanese and don't marry black.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Don't marry Japanese because of all the terrible things that the Japanese did. Don't marry black because this is racist, right? That you find that. And I just don't find... I find that, like, a lot of people were asking me, because I also married out, what did your parents think, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But I actually didn't get that necessarily from my parents. So I can't really say that the Japanese... in particular, are more resistant to Chinese or, you know. The thing that gets complicated also is that you find, you know, the sort of intra-Asian resentment, especially because of what the Japanese did, their crimes in World War II. So I had a friend who's actually Sansei, third generation, whose Chinese-American boyfriend, his parents protested because of what the Japanese did, despite the fact that her grandparents had already immigrated to the United States before Japan, you know, went on its rampage against Indonesia. Am I making sense? I mean, so I really haven't seen this sort of, like, a pecking order, in a sense, that you're saying about certain Asians being resistant to intermarriage and other Asians, but I just haven't done any research on that, so I can't say.
Yeah, certainly not in the American culture once they get here, but to return to the country may be uncomfortable. You know, if someone were, in terms of intermarriage, talked to a couple here that's what happened. He was Japanese, and they lived, they had a child, and there just felt a little bit uncomfortable back in the country. But anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I suppose it is true, one thing that you have to say about Japan, it's not an easy place for a foreigner to live.
That's
and
true.
It is extremely, if you were not born in Japan, say that you were an American and you moved to Japan and you married a Japanese and you decided you wanted to become a Japanese citizen, it's not that it's impossible. But it's pretty close. It's extremely, extremely difficult for someone who is not born in Japan to become a Japanese citizen.
It's difficult. And it's I guess, worse in a sense for Japanese Americans who go back, right? Because they're American, but they look Japanese, have Japanese genes, but they don't exactly seem Japanese, since they seem as sort of oddballs in a sense. Mm-hmm. Well, what must be even more difficult are the Filipino women who are now going to marry Japanese farmers, women who grew up in Japanese farms don't want to be farmers' wives. They're all going to the city, and so Japanese farmers are finding that they have to marry out from poor Asian nations, and they must have it incredibly tough.
Yeah. Well, we're coming down to the point here. We maybe have a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to come to some point of closure. Maybe I would just ask about here now this, where we are now, and if you can say something about attitudes towards Japan now, particularly now that we've come through a point where there was this period where Japan was an important ally and we were thinking about how we were trying to, from the American perspective, we were helping Japan, giving them the hand up and so forth. And then we come into the period eventually of intense competition, economic competition between Japan and the United States, where people are using these old warlike metaphors.
They're talking about
it comes back again as if it's like World War II all over again,
right.
This time on economic terms, and
right.
This time we might not win. Well, then that kind of went on for a while until the Japanese economy really went into a long period of decline, and it seems that we've gotten past that. But then the question is, well, what exactly is our relationship with Japan, and what do we think about Japan now?
What do we think about Japan now?
Yeah.
Well, right now we're at a point where I think the relationships are very friendly. The United, I mean, even despite that they had that sort of difficult time in the late 70s or early 80s, the Japanese and the Americans have been sort of like very vital allies to each other, especially in the Far East. And so you find that that fundamental geopolitical relationship has never been very altered. What's happening culturally right now is that you find both the negative and the positive. This is what happens when there's not a crisis. When there's not a crisis, you have both the images of geisha and maybe even some images of the sort of fanatical Jap floating around, right, or the samurai, that both are going around. But I think that if you want to think about what I'm doing and use it more productively for now, is you want to look at Korea, or North Korea particularly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the message that I would like people to think about is to think about ways in which we're looking at North Korea, because the way we're looking at North Korea today is precisely the way we were looking at Japan during the 1940s, as inscrutable, crazy, fanatic, without a reason, or what have you. And that you find these same sort of othering, a sense of just of people being dehumanized as robots or complete out of the realm of comprehension that is happening to North Koreans in particular today, as it was in Japan. And so you might want to think about that. I strongly urge people to think about the ways in we look at the North Korean leader. I mean, he's become a caricature, and that. I think that's kind of dangerous because we don't take seriously. We take seriously since they might go, you know, use nuclear bomb or what have you, but not seriously enough. We don't consider seriously enough who they are, what their needs are, and to what degree they may be legitimate or not. This is not to excuse any sort of political move or what have you. Certainly, I'm not trying to be an apologist for Japanese empire, but they had a reason for doing what they did. They felt insecure after the Great Depression. They believed the international system wouldn't work. They thought the only thing they could do is to create a self-sufficient empire in autarky. That's why they thought it was absolutely essential that they needed to invade China. Now, I don't agree with that. I think it was wrong. What they did in Asia is a tremendous, huge crime for which the Japanese have not completely owned up to, as we know. But there's a rationale, and to understand the rationale is the first step in trying to better or to conduct foreign policy. Yeah.
There, we're going to have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Naoko Shibasawa, Assistant Professor of History at Brown University. Her book is America's Geisha Ally, Reimagining the Japanese Enemy, published by the Harvard University Press. Professor Shibasawa, thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much.